Well, thank you, Mark, and thank you to City for the opportunity to speak today. And I too would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. My topic today is a quite focused one. I want to talk about the so-called neutral real interest rate. This concept has attracted a lot of attention in recent months, and it's no surprise why. Until earlier this year, policy interest rates in Australia, the cash rate target, had been held at very low levels to support economies through the COVID-19 pandemic and into recovery. Such low levels of the cash rate are understood to be unusual. They are an emergency setting for extraordinary times. But now, with the unemployment rate close to a 50-year low and inflation currently very high, policy stimulus is no longer needed. In these circumstances, it's natural to think of policy getting back to a more normal setting, although one could argue that times are still far from normal, just in a different way to the previous 2 years. Regardless, it's understandable that in recent months, people have been wondering what normal policy might be. And to the extent that that means no longer providing stimulus, this then becomes a question of what neutral policy might mean. Economic theory contemplates a risk-free or policy rate that can be considered neutral. This rate, whatever it is usually labelled R star. So today I'm going to talk about how a neutral rate might be defined and measured, what might determine its level, and how we might respond knowing that it could change. In doing so, I want to emphasise that the neutral interest rate is a long-run concept. I mean, there are other ways of thinking about it. Some people do talk about the distinction between a short-run R star and a long-run R star. But the way I think is most fruitful in most circumstances is to think of it as a long-run concept. So what is it? Well, when the policy interest rate is low enough, it stimulates demand. And when it's high enough, it restrains demand. So somewhere in the middle, there must be a rate that is neither contractionary nor expansionary. Well, that's one way to frame the neutral rate, and certainly that's how we've defined it publicly in the past. Dig a little deeper, though, and there are some subtleties in this definition that are worth unpacking. Consider what it means for policy to be stimulatory. Growth would tend to increase, unemployment decline, and inflation accelerate. But what if some negative shock hits the economy that offsets the effect of monetary policy? Well, then we wouldn't see those tendencies be borne out in the data. This means that when we think about policy being expansionary or contractionary, underneath those concepts is always the question, compared with what? Well, compared with the situation if we'd held interest rates at a different level. It's all kind of relative, isn't it? So rather than seeing the economy expand or slow in response to the stance of policy, at times policy will only be cushioning the effects of forces working in the other direction. And that's why the neutral rate is best thought of as a long-run concept. It's the interest rate that keeps growth at trend and inflation constant at target when no other shocks are hitting the economy. Put another way, it's where the policy rate settles once all the shocks have played out. Still another definition stems from the first, because for growth to be constant at its trend rate and inflation to be constant at target, the levels of desired saving and desired investment must balance each other. So the neutral rate can also be described as the level of the policy rate that balances desired saving and investment. Now, this framing can be quite useful when thinking about the determinants of the level of the neutral rate and therefore what might cause the neutral rate to change. Now, before turning to the question of how to measure the neutral rate, we should note some important features that are implied by these definitions. First, the neutral rate is not directly observable. Like all the other so-called star variables, such as the NIRU, or the rate of growth in potential output, it has to be inferred from data. Second, it's mostly a global concept. Capital can flow across borders. This means that the desired saving and desired investment that must be balanced are global desired saving and global desired investment. Shifts in desired saving and investment globally therefore influence the neutral rate across economies. Now, that said, country-specific factors also matter. For example, economies with above-average trend growth may attract more investment, leading to a higher neutral rate in that country. Neutral real interest rates can therefore differ across economies, even if capital is fully mobile across borders. Neutral rates expressed in nominal terms can also differ if trend inflation differs across countries. So, different inflation targets imply different nominal neutral rates, even though the neutral real rate won't necessarily be different. Thirdly, the neutral rate is an emergent property of the system. The neutral rate arises from the combined behaviour of many actors in the economy. It's not an exogenous variable from outside the system, it doesn't come down from heaven, and it shouldn't be treated as such. Rather, causation runs both ways. Economic outcomes can influence the level of the neutral rate, and vice versa. So we should expect that it can change over time, and that these changes have underlying economic explanations. Changes in the neutral rate are not random, they're not external shocks. So like the other so-called star variables, like the NIRU or the rate of growth and potential output, like these other star variables, the neutral rate is an economic fundamental, but fundamental does not mean fixed. Finally, the neutral rate is a real interest rate. Economic theory holds that it is real inflation-adjusted interest rates that matter for people's savings and investment decisions. People look through the expected inflation component of nominal rates. Lenders expect to be compensated for it, and borrowers expect to have to provide that compensation. Now, real interest rates are not readily observed, however, and so monetary policy is conducted in nominal terms. And that means that once you've inferred the level of the neutral real rate, you have to translate back to the nominal rate by reflating, using some measure of inflation. Now, the choice of which inflation measure to use is not clear-cut. If you're focusing on these longer-run conceptions of the neutral rate, a longer-run or trend rate of inflation makes the most sense. But there are other choices. The saving investment decisions that inform the level of the neutral rate depend on expectations of the future. As such, it makes sense to use some measure of inflation expectations, ideally over a multi-year horizon, and this adds another layer of uncertainty to the calculation. Inflation expectations are imperfectly measured at every horizon, and it is not obvious which horizon should be used. A one-year horizon is a common choice, and I will show it in some of the graphs in this speech, and I hope that they pop up when I press the button. But it is a choice driven largely by data availability, rather than being well-grounded in theory or empirical evidence. Another approach is to use the inflation target. So in our case, we'd use the midpoint of the target band. And you can justify that by the definition of the neutral rate as the rate that keeps inflation at target and growth at trend. Now, given the difficulties and judgments involved in choosing a forward-looking inflation rate, people sometimes resort to using recent observed inflation instead. And that is completely understandable. Most of the time, when inflation's stable, it won't put you too far wrong. Now, conceptually, it isn't quite right, though. People's decisions depend on their beliefs about the future, not solely on the recent past. And there are times when using past inflation produces very different estimates of current real rates than a trend or forward-looking measure. And we're definitely in one of those times. Current inflation is very high. It is expected to stay high in the short term. But beyond the next year, inflation expectations remain well anchored inside the target range, both here and overseas. Using the current or near-term inflation rate would imply that real interest rates were very negative at the moment. That doesn't seem like the right conclusion to draw. If it were true, well, imagine how exuberant borrowing behaviour would be. So that just doesn't seem like the right conclusion. So while we can learn something from that calculation, and I'll show it later, it isn't our preferred measure. Another little wrinkle I want to mention is that measuring the real rate could also be subject to perception biases. It's possible that saving and investment decisions depend more on people's and firms' expectations about growth in their own prices and wages than on their expectations about inflation in the whole economy. And if these own price expectations are systematically biased, they will not aggregate to the expected rate of inflation in the whole economy. That is, when you ask people what they expect inflation across the whole economy to be, you will get a different answer than if you could aggregate all these own price expectations that actually drive people's behaviour. And if these biases are large enough, the real rate you infer by subtracting an economy-wide measure of inflation expectations won't be the real rate that people actually perceive and act on. So how do we measure the real rate in practice, so the neutral rate in practice? I mean, the definitions of the neutral rate just described relate to a long run when all the shocks have worked their way through. So to infer it, you have to identify those confounding shocks and strip out their effects on the economy. And that's no small task. Fortunately, we have data and econometric models, so the cause isn't completely hopeless. Before we get into those more sophisticated approaches to measurement, it is worth mentioning one helpful rule of thumb, which is in the long run, the neutral real rate is highly likely to be positive. And this is because of time preference. People would rather have a dollar now than a dollar tomorrow or next year. They demand some compensation for having to wait, even if the payoff next year is risk-free. Because the policy rate represents the risk-free short-term interest rate, it embeds people's underlying time preference. So we should expect the neutral real rate also to be positive, though it could be small. And when you add in the condition that inflation should be at target in the long run, it implies a nominal neutral rate in Australia of at least 2.5%. Because the definition of the neutral rate can be framed in different ways, and because of the inherent difficulties in measurement, at the bank, we use 9 different models to estimate it. These 9 models are derived from 3 broad approaches, and for each approach, we construct 3 models, each with minor variations. In the first approach, the neutral rate is inferred from financial market pricing. It estimates the neutral rate as the average of expected future short-term real interest rates derived from a model of the term structure of nominal and real interest rates, adjusting for term premia. And we've published that model. The underlying assumption from this approach is that the real interest rate should revert to its neutral rate over time as the effects of shocks fade. And these 3 models estimated using this approach simply assume different horizons over which the interest rate settles at neutral, whether it's 3, 5, or 10 years. The second approach we use is to use a statistical model to infer the neutral rate at each point in time as the level of the real policy rate that would prevail if inflation's at target, output's at potential, and the economy's at full employment. And then the model updates its estimate of the neutral rate and all those other concepts like output being at potential and where full employment is. It updates those estimates each quarter based on how much some of the variables deviate from what the model predicted for the previous quarter. And this method makes some pretty strong assumptions about the structure of the economy. They're standard assumptions, but they are pretty strong, including about the relationship between output and inflation, and about the gap between the cash rate and the neutral rate. The 3 specific models we use allow for varying emphases on different drivers of inflation. For example, how important domestic factors are relative to global factors. The third approach we use is a more flexible statistical model to forecast the future value of the policy rate once all the cyclical influences have dissipated, and then use that as the estimate of the neutral rate. And the idea is that this forecast is the trend value to which the policy rate will converge based on structural influences. In practice, this method makes fewer assumptions about the economic structure than the second approach. But you need to understand that its estimates will only be plausible if a forecast of the future actual policy rate is actually a good estimate of the neutral rate. We then take a simple average across the 9 models to derive a central estimate of the neutral real rate. This is a completely standard approach to dealing with model uncertainty. You know, one model is never enough. Nonetheless, it is important to remember that each model is estimated with considerable uncertainty, and we're combining these highly uncertain estimates. And you can see from the grey swathe on this graph the wide range of different model estimates. They span from -5% to about 2%, and the model average is just under 1%. So how has the neutral rate changed over time? I mean, the other point to note about the estimates in the graph is that they've declined over the course of several decades, and noticeably so in the wake of the global financial crisis. This decline is common globally, and that's to be expected as the neutral rate largely rests, as I mentioned, on global factors. The causes of this common trend are less clear-cut, however. Many possible explanations have been proposed in the literature. Some are more plausible than others, and of course, there could be more than one thing going on. I mean, in general, there is. Now, one possible cause is the apparent decline in potential output growth, which has been a multi-decade trend common across advanced economies. Lower potential growth reduces expected future demand. In turn, it reduces firms' incentive to invest and so decreases the interest rate that balances investment with desired savings. Slower growth in potential output can stem from lower productivity growth or population ageing or a combination of the two. We know that productivity growth has slowed over the past few decades in Australia and elsewhere. The many candidate explanations for this, including reduced innovation, increased regulation, slower adoption of innovation, reduced business dynamism, and reduced competition. The trend has been obscured lately by the effects of the pandemic. As best as we can tell, though, this slow productivity performance has continued below the surface. The effect of slower population growth and population ageing is a bit more nuanced. In principle, population ageing should lower saving because more people are retired and drawing down on their savings. But this effect seems to be overshadowed in practice by the need to increase saving as longevity increases. That is, people need to save more to fund a longer period in retirement. Now, other factors beyond potential growth could also help to explain the decline in neutral rates. One of these is reduced risk appetite. The uncertainty that prevailed following the global financial crisis dampened firms' appetite to invest. Instead, the focus turned to cost cutting. It also encouraged households to increase precautionary saving and reduce debt. In Australia, this was evidenced in the broadly stable ratio of debt to income, even though lower interest rates would ordinarily encourage leverage. Risk aversion also showed up as increased demand for safe assets, such as liquid and highly rated bonds, by global investors, especially central banks in emerging markets, and also pension funds in advanced economies. A related explanation of the decline in the neutral rate is the global savings glut hypothesis. Recall the early discussion of how the neutral rate balances global desired savings and global desired investment. And so if some factor drives up desired saving without also enhancing investment opportunities, the neutral rate necessarily falls. According to this explanation, following the Asian financial crisis, governments in emerging Asia built up foreign exchange reserves to prevent something similar happening to them again. The counterpart to that reaction was that these countries ran large current account surpluses. They switched from being net importers to net exporters of capital. The resulting increased global saving flowed into advanced economies and put downward pressure on interest rates. An alternative explanation of higher desired saving rate focuses more on advanced economies than emerging Asia. According to this view, deregulation, lower inflation, and other factors resulted in debt expanding relative to incomes. This lifted servicing burdens relative to incomes at any given nominal interest rate, and thereby raised the saving rate represented by repayments of principal. Another explanation for lower neutral rates is that they've been driven by increased inequality. This relies on the observation that saving rates tend to be higher for high-income households, and high-income households' share of overall income has tended to increase since the 1980s, which is the same period over which the neutral interest rate has been estimated to have fallen. Because global saving and investment influence the domestic neutral rate, increased inequality globally can reduce the neutral rate in Australia, even though income inequality has not increased by as much here. Now, these explanations for lower neutral rates are largely based on structural factors. Another possibility is that cyclical influences might be persistent enough that standard models read them as influencing the neutral rate. One such influence might be the global stance of fiscal policy. I mean, its effects are quite hard to disentangle. Expansionary fiscal policy boosts demand in the short run, but might reduce expected future growth in the long run if people focus on the need to fund current fiscal spending. But on the other hand, if fiscal policy is persistently tight, it is likely that monetary policy will have to be persistently accommodative to offset the contractionary influence on the economy. And if your model of the neutral rate does not explicitly allow for the global stance of fiscal policy, it will interpret it this as having the neutral rate having fallen. And this omission might go some way to explaining a puzzle surrounding standard estimates of the neutral rate. Yes, the neutral rate is estimated to have fallen, but policy rates fell even more over the last 15 years, and they've been consistently below estimates of the neutral rate for a decade, regardless of what model you use, regardless of what different inflation measure you use to back out the nominal rate, as I've done here. Now, despite this, inflation stayed low, both in Australia and in other advanced economies. Something must have been offsetting this apparently expansionary policy. Fiscal consolidation in the wake of the global financial crisis, particularly in Europe, could have been part of that. I think that's been an underappreciated factor in the past 15 years or so. However you slice it, though, the neutral real rate has declined. And so what are the consequences of this? I mean, it's not necessarily good or bad for the neutral rate to be at a particular level. It is just is what it is. Given the possible role of demography and inequality in bringing the neutral rate to low levels, it is plausible that low neutral rates persist for the foreseeable future. And if so, there are some implications to consider. A low neutral rate in a low inflation world means that the economy could be more frequently constrained by the effect of lower bound on nominal interest rates. It becomes harder to stimulate the economy when needed. The central bank possibly has to resort to other measures beyond reducing the cash rate to support the economy. And this is one reason why central banks have inflation targets that are above zero. Another implication is that can it make it harder to achieve a desired rate of return? So investors with a mandate to achieve an absolute return could end up taking on risk that they would not otherwise take. Alternatively, the neutral rate could increase at some point. This is also plausible. The factors holding back productivity growth could dissipate. Asian governments will not necessarily continue to accumulate foreign reserves at the rate they did in the early 2000s. And fiscal consolidation might not be as much of a priority as it was in Europe in the early 2010s. An increase in the neutral rate has important implications, which will depend crucially on the cause of the increase. For example, those who look forward to a future of faster productivity growth must recognise that this will likely imply higher real rates as well as higher trend growth. This matters for investors, borrowers, and fiscal authorities alike. These implications are mostly benign, but not if global productivity growth picks up and Australia does not keep pace. A future increase in the neutral rate would also have implications for balance sheets. Lower average nominal interest rates mean that you can service more debt for the same repayment. If the reason average nominal rates are lower is a permanent disinflation, as occurred after Australia adopted inflation targeting in the 1990s, the resulting expansion in balance sheets is sustainable. But if average, nominal or real rates, increase again, some deleveraging would be needed. And that process is unlikely to be painless. If that were to occur, interest rate buffers become particularly valuable. In Australia and some other countries, banks determine allowable loan sizes by assessing a borrower's capacity to pay based on an interest rate that is higher than the currently prevailing rate. These measures are designed to ensure that borrowers don't overstretch and end up in distress from normal cyclical moves in interest rates. But it is easy to see that these buffers also provide some margin to cushion the adjustment if average real rates were to increase in the future. In this way, short-term prudence also supports long-term prudence. So, what does it all mean for policy? Well, having considered all the possible drivers of the neutral real rate and the measurement difficulties, which are not trivial, I'd like to briefly conclude by considering the question of how that translates into our policy practice. The Reserve Bank is responsible for meeting a flexible inflation target. As set out in our various communications over recent months, the Board's objective is to get inflation back to target. What that implies for the policy rate depends on what else is going on. Some factors could be dragging on growth and inflation, others could be boosting them. We make a holistic assessment of the forces that are affecting the economy and whether they might be reinforcing or offsetting the impact of monetary policy. It just isn't a simple mapping from inflation forecast to desired policy stance. The framework that brings that assessment together is our forecasting process, including the risks around our central projections. While far from perfect, a full-blown whole economy forecast reduces the chance that we would miss something important. So as I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, and has been clear for some time, the strong recovery of the economy and high rate of inflation mean that the previous setting of a cash rate near 0% is definitely no longer appropriate. But don't think of this as a mechanistic approach of, well, we have to get back to neutral or above neutral. The neutral rate is an important guide rail for thinking about the effect that policy might be having. It is not necessarily a prescription for what policy should do. Neutral rate, then, is not a destination we necessarily reach, but more a pole star to guide us. And even then, its location is sufficiently uncertain that we are perhaps better served by paying more attention to the ground as it shifts beneath our feet than to that faraway pole star. We need to be mindful of the limitations of our instruments and of the prospect that the stars themselves can realign. But as we navigate the narrow path to our intended goal, we welcome any faint light that those stars may cast. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for that, putting the mics on. I think as an economist, I found that incredibly informative, and I really do appreciate the fact that you've actually brought down to first principles how the RBA thinks about the neutral rate. I actually think that, you know, as we go back and digest this speech, I think this will be proved to be one of the most important RBA speeches, I think, that's been given since the start of the pandemic. I really do think it was that good. We do have time for questions, and I'll be moderating those. I will take the prerogative of being able to ask the first one. You did mention in your speech and that, you know, you could, you know, in Australia the R star is at least 2.5%, and you showed the range of estimates around what looked to be closer to sort of 3, maybe 3.5, and in a nominal sense. I'm just wondering whether, having moved the cash rate from 2.35 to 2.6% at the most recent meeting, whether that thinking about neutral was something that impacted the decision to move from a 50 basis point to 25, or if you could tell us what other considerations the board and the staff made in making that new decision.
Thanks for that, Josh. Look, I'm not going to talk specifically about the discussion in the board. The minutes will provide some more information about that when they come out. I want to just acknowledge that a lot of my speech was based on a briefing that we gave to the board in July, and to thank the team who put that together. So it was part, certainly, you know, we've had those discussions with the board over, you know, over a range of months, and you know, particularly in July, and so that is part of the background of the discussion. But yes, there were plenty of other decisions around those tactics. So I guess the way you can think about it is we knew zero was not right anymore. We needed to get back to somewhere that was not obviously out of whack. Where we end up with, really, as I said in my speech, just depends on what else is going on. There have been so many significant shocks in the economy. We're seeing you know, a lot of the supply-based shocks that stem from the pandemic are starting to come off now, but we're now grappling with a global energy cost shock, and that could persist for a while. So other things are going on, but, you know, we're no longer, you know, manifestly, you know, in an expansionary place. And so, you know, there are a number of factors that went into the decision, you know, about how much to move this month, but the knowledge that we were no longer, you know, incredibly expansionary was part of that background.
Thank you for that. We do have some roving microphones, so if you'd like to ask a question of Dr. Ellis, please put your hand up. Yep, we have some questions already. We have Matt Sherwood and Brett Gillespie. They can fight over who gets to ask first. The microphone's coming around. Please just, if you do ask a question, just state your name and your affiliation, please. Thank you.
Thanks. Brett Gillespie from CBA Treasury. I noticed you know, quantitative easing or global quantitative easing doesn't figure in any of that calculation. Is that something, can you explain, you know, is that something that has no effect on neutral interest rates? Is there any sort of savings investment dimension there?
I think the neutral rate being a long run concept, it shouldn't affect your neutral rate, but it does affect where you are at the moment. And so, yeah, quantitative easing, quantitative tightening are in that bucket of other things are happening and you have to allow for that.
Thanks for your presentation, Dr. Ellis. I'm really intrigued by the usefulness of R-star more broadly, particularly in the world we live in now with decarbonisation, where energy prices in Northern Hemisphere winters may skyrocket and then just come back when demand falls away. But the big interest is actually the confidence intervals around it and how you balance the average estimate around that confidence interval, because you couldn't be statistically confident that you actually know whether you're stimulating the economy or restricting it.
Yeah, I mean, Matt, thanks, Matt, and such formality. We've known each other long enough. But really, yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the reasons I gave the speech I gave, is I want people to understand that, you know, these star variables are not just these point estimates that you can say, well, I'm, you know, I'm going to go to here and then I'm going to do that. That's not how the world works. And, you know, the uncertainties of the task we've been given are huge. So I think it's important to acknowledge that. You know, I think it's fair to say when we had rates at zero, it was clear that policy was stimulatory. Where we are now, I think one could say there is some positive probability that we are not stimulating the economy, but I wouldn't put that probability at anywhere near 100% just yet.
Good morning, Dr. Ellis. It's Rory Robertson from Westpac Group Treasury. Dr. Ellis, thanks for your talk on the detail of the Nutrarate in Australia. I hope it's not unkind of me to observe that, you know, across the world, from a practical perspective, pretty well all major central banks, put rates way below neutral, near zero, the lowest rates in the history of humans across the world. And I think the consensus criticism from market investors and lots of other observers is that, you know, rates were kept ridiculously low for too long and fueled a boom in labour markets and home prices. So central banks are part of amplifying the cycle. Like, central banks in history have wanted to knock the tops off booms and put a base in recessions. And in this case, it seems the other way around is the criticism. In Australia, I guess I was very surprised to see the bank's published liaison data in a six-panel chart that showed neatly that, you know, by the middle of last year, the economy seemed to be, you know, so we're all sort of fumbling around trying to look at ANZ job ads and, you know, SEEK and NAB surveys and the GDP numbers and this, that and the other thing, trying to, you know, triangulate all the data and understand what's going on. The bank, it had internally a set of data that was perfectly consistent, was custom made in the way that economists want, and all the data, the demand, the wages, the employment, costs, prices, they're all normalising, and yet the Reserve Bank sort of wandered into 2022 with this extraordinarily low interest rate setting and with saying it would be patient. So there's a criticism that says central banks should avoid fine-tuning, and yet the Reserve Bank was busily fine-tuning, trying to get, you know, inflation up another quarter or half point. And then everyone across the world got caught with their rates down by the invasion of Ukraine. So everyone's doing aggressive rate hikes, introducing new problems so rates too low for long, moving up very sharply, causing lots of problems. So my question is, if the Reserve Bank had its time again, given it's got this great liaison data, and given that, there's always the potential for shocks, would the Reserve Bank have started normalising rates earlier, given that the emergency seemed to be over, you know, a year or two before? I mean, the other question, so would the Reserve Bank have moved rates up earlier? And also, is it fair to observe that the official families across the world grossly overestimated the potential damage to society and economies from what turned out to be a relatively weak virus?
Well, thanks, Rory. Once again, the formality. We've known each other a long time. Look, there's a big red ticking clock that says I've got 1 minute 59 left before Larry Summers comes on screen. So let me try to do what I can in 1 minute 53. I think, you know, two points I'd make. One is, thinking back to a year ago, or just over a year ago, we were still in lockdown. This was not, you know, it was quite unclear that Australia would continue forward with opening up. At the time, the discourse was all about go hard, go early, and Omicron hadn't happened yet. We were expecting things to still be very weak. And even, you know, the lack of clarity we had about, you know, we knew that things tended to bounce back pretty quickly after lockdowns, but we didn't have a whole lot of faith in that over the summer. And I also want to remind everybody of the context where, you know, prior to the pandemic, we had consistently overestimated inflation and wages growth in our forecasts. We'd been continuously disappointed about wages growth. We didn't fully understand why that was. And we wanted to see inflation actually in the target band and be confident on the basis of, as you mentioned, not only hard data but our liaison, that wages growth was picking up as we expected, so that we could be confident that inflation would actually be sustained in the target band. And I think the Governor has addressed this, you know, in some detail in the past as well. But yeah, I acknowledge that that is a perspective, and I can see why people have come to that conclusion. But I would, you know, it seems like a long time ago now, but I think the context of where we were last year, you know, was one where you could not be confident of that fast bounce back. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy. And we are exactly out of time. I think we've had the fantastic introduction to day one of the conference. As Lucy said, we have Larry Summers in here now, but if you prefer, there is actually a consumer grocery panel in the room across the hall. Thank you very much for your attendance. Thank you.